listening to The Coffee Hour. I'm Andy Bates.
I'm Sarah Golseth.
We are continuing our history series on Pilgrims, Puritans, and the founding of New England with Dr. McKenzie today. Thanks to Concordia University, Wisconsin for supporting The Coffee Hour. Find out more about Concordia University, Wisconsin at cuw.edu.
Live uncommon.
Joining us for this series, the Reverend Dr. Cameron McKenzie, Professor of Historical Theology at Concordia Theological Seminary in Fort Wayne, Indiana. Dr. McKenzie, welcome back.
Well, thanks for having me. I'm glad to be here again.
I'm ready to talk more about Pilgrims, Puritans, and the founding of New England. Last time we left off learning more about Roger Williams and Rhode Island. Where do you want to pick up with that today?
Well, let's finish up Roger Williams. We don't have a whole lot more to say about him, but his life is interesting and it is significant. I think I mentioned last time that Williams, one of the founders of Rhode Island, was concerned about getting Rhode Island, getting a legal status from the English government. And he got that early in the period of the Civil War. He got it from the parliamentary side. He comes back to Rhode Island. Another time he goes to England. And actually, the second time he goes to England, he returns as governor of Rhode Island. So he becomes the governor of Rhode Island in 1657. And one of the distinguishing marks of his governorship was that he welcomed into the colony the first Jews. I'm not sure if it'd be Jews in America, but it was certainly the first Jews in New England. And that, too, has kind of an interesting history to it. It was way back at the end of the 13th century that King Edward I banned Jews from England. It was Oliver Cromwell, when he was in power in the 1650s, who let Jews return to England for the first time in like about 250 years. And Roger Williams followed suit then in Rhode Island in 1657. Regarding his continued history, he engages in politics, engages in merchandise. He really is no longer a clergyman. In 1672, some Quakers came to Rhode Island, and although Williams debated them publicly and dismissed their ideas, nonetheless, he thought that Jews and Quakers, as well as other religious dissidents, should be permitted to live in peace in Rhode Island. In terms of his own personal theology, it was in 1639, again, earlier in his life and career, that he became a Baptist. He endorsed the idea that one should be baptized after he has had an experience of the Spirit, after he would confess Christ. So he, like many of his contemporaries, he rejects baptism as a real means of grace. But for him, all the Old Testament stuff is irrelevant to New Testament stuff. And that meant he rejected circumcision as somehow kind of a precursor to baptism. So it was in 1639 that he became a Baptist. And during that year, he joined with about a dozen others in establishing the first Baptist church in America. The first Baptist church in America is one of the founders of that. However, a few months later, Williams withdrew from even that church and announced to his fellow Christians that he was a seeker. And what do you mean by that? Well, he had not yet discovered a true church. Now, if you were tracking with me last time, you saw how uncomfortable he was with all the other churches. So it's no surprise that he was uncomfortable now with the Baptist and finally gave up on really finding any church that could satisfy him. So he left the ministry, denied the legitimacy of all the established churches. He believed that in the corruption of the Middle Ages, the church had lost its authority. He wrote, "God's people are now in the gospel brought into a spiritual land of Canaan. Therefore, an enforced settled maintenance is not suitable to the gospel as it was to the ministry of priests and Levites under the law." So as far as Williams was concerned, restoration of the true church could only occur by a mighty interposition of God. And that brings him to like millennial thoughts about God restoring everything when Christ comes back. So he rejected the relevance of the Old Testament to Christian life and society. With the coming of Christ, all Old Testament forms, ceremonies, institutions were abrogated. Men were free to seek their own salvation, unencumbered by any government, whether a government of church or of the world. So for the rest of his life, Williams was a theological loner, basically a Calvinist in thinking about the sovereignty of God and so forth, but an early advocate of religious liberty. He died in poverty, but still a Christian, kind of a precursor of the non-denominational evangelicals of our time. So that's Roger Williams. Okay, now, what we want to do next is talk about the changing face of New England religiously as we get into the second and third generations of the founders. So that's where we're going next. This period in New England church history is sometimes called the period of declension or declining. And it has to do with the failure of the next generation to experience the Spirit and join the church. So let me talk a little bit about that. We saw in a previous episode that the New England way was located kind of halfway between full Presbyterianism, because the Presbyterians held to a national church establishment where everybody was in the church from little on up, unless by discipline they had to be kicked out. And then on the other hand, you had the Baptists, who held that the church consisted of visible saints only, and that wouldn't be clear until you were grown up. And then the sign of your sainthood was being baptized. But the New England way, as defined by the Cambridge Platform, tried to have it both ways. It insisted that for full church membership, visible sainthood, if you will, had to be related to an already existing church whereby you adopted the covenant and became, as an adult, a full member. Nonetheless, the children of members were a part of the covenant family, just as the children of Abraham and his descendants as babies became a part of the covenant community of Israel. Okay. Well, a problem arose over the years after that settlement, probably one that they really hadn't thought of when they made that settlement, is what do you do with your baptized members, that is the ones who were baptized as babies, who as adults continue to come to church, they continue to confess their belief in the truths of the Christian religion, in the confessions and creeds of the Puritan establishment, and they also live good outwardly Christian lives, but they don't experience grace in the way that the founders thought they ought to experience grace. Or if they experience it, they don't want to relate it, and they don't subsequently proceed to full membership. Now, one of the things you have to realize is that full membership did enable you to participate in the Lord's Supper. And they have a high view of the Lord's Supper, but it's not the means of grace the way it is in Lutheranism. It's just kind of a divinely instituted way of reminding you of what Christ did. And so I guess you could say to yourself, if you're a Christian, well, it's not that important that I go to the Lord's Supper and that I become a communicant member. So I don't know really what they were thinking, but you had a lot of young people growing up, becoming adults, getting married, etc., and not becoming full communicant members. Okay. By the 1650s, therefore, it was pretty clear that the churches of New England were not being nourished by sufficient numbers of conversions to maintain their position as a majority of the adults in New England. They were in very real danger of becoming a minority. And so fears arose then that New England might in effect become pagan. If you don't get the conversions, you don't get the church membership, fewer and fewer people in a town belong to the church, what are you going to do? All right. Well, the government of Massachusetts, the general court, convinced, I don't think I mentioned it earlier. Only communicant members can vote in Massachusetts, okay? So the number of voters is not keeping up with the population either. So, all right, so they realize that this is a problem. And so they summoned what they called a synod of the congregations and clergy in 1662 to consider this problem. What are we going to do about this? And they argued back and forth until finally they agreed upon something called the halfway covenant. The halfway covenant, which made provisions for halfway membership in the church. And basically what that said is if you had a baptized member who continued to live an upright life and who publicly agreed with the teachings of the church, confessed the faith, submitted to its discipline, the discipline of the church, then even though he was not a communicant member, he could still present his offspring for baptism. And accordingly, you'd get baptized members coming along on a regular basis, even if they never became full communicant members. So it's called the halfway covenant with halfway members baptized. They continue to be members, never become communicant members, but nonetheless, they submit themselves to the discipline of the church and their children can be baptized. So we can continue to have an established church in every village that's never going to run out of members the way you would if you had that original plan regarding membership. So the purpose of the halfway covenant was to bring descendants of visible saints under the discipline of the church without violating the principle of visible sainthood. In other words, they gave legitimacy to the church's monopoly on organized worship and to its continued demand for support from the entire community. It's still the community church. And they also hoped that if these baptized members would agree with church doctrine and discipline, that might prove then to be just an interim step toward full communicant membership. Now, that was a hope that was never realized by the majority of New England residents. So we've got this official church, lots of halfway members, and only a minority of communicant members. This created a lot of opposition and sometimes leading to schism. In fact, in 1662, there was still one of the original founders serving as a pastor, and he was serving as the pastor of the first church in New Haven in Connecticut. Even though he's advanced in age, he accepted a call to First Church in Boston in order to oppose the halfway covenant. All right. So as an old man, he moves to Boston so he can preach and teach against that halfway covenant. As a result, about 70 members of the First Church withdrew to form yet another church that would embrace the halfway covenant. So you've got churches that are splitting over this kind of new notion of what church membership would consist of. Eventually, most of the New England churches accepted the halfway covenant, even though by 1700, there were still about 20% of the congregations which did.
We can pick up there After we take a quick break, you're listening to The Coffee Hour. I'm Sarah Golseth.
I'm Andy Bates. At Concordia University, Wisconsin, we believe you were created for a reason, to use your God-given gifts to help others, to live a life of self-sacrifice in a me-first world, to live a life that's uncommon. Whether you're taking one of 50-plus online programs or learning with us in person on the shores of Lake Michigan, you'll be equipped to make an uncommon impact. Learn more at cuw.edu. Concordia University, Wisconsin. Live uncommon.
Welcome back to The Coffee Hour. I'm Sarah Golseth.
I'm Andy Bates.
We're talking with the Reverend Dr. Cameron McKenzie, Professor of Historical Theology at Concordia Theological Seminary in Fort Wayne, Indiana, on the history of Pilgrims, Puritans, and the founding of New England. And before I went to break, we're talking about the Halfway Covenant and the drama that ensued between different churches and people for and against this Halfway Covenant. Where are we going with this story now?
Well, we're going to talk more about the decline in kind of that first generation enthusiasm and spirit for creating the perfect church in New England. I just want to mention here, though, that this move had kind of long-range significance in that the Congregationalist churches remained the established religions of both Massachusetts and Connecticut well into the 19th century. And sometimes we forget that the First Amendment, which guarantees religious liberty, did not actually apply to the states. And Massachusetts and Connecticut continued to recognize the congregational churches as the official religion of their states well into the period of the American nation. But that wouldn't have happened without the Halfway Covenant. The Halfway Covenant kind of saves these churches for continuing on as the legitimate church of the colony. Now, by the time we get to the second generation, once again, things in England have changed. The period of the Civil War and the attempt at having a republic in England instead of a monarchy fails by 1660. And accordingly, the monarchy is restored. And that means the Church of England is going to be restored. The Book of Common Prayer is going to be restored. And you're going to continue to have kind of religious controversy in England under the newly restored monarchy. And that's going to have implications for New England as well. So the adoption of the Halfway Covenant does not take care of all New England's religious ills. The restoration of Charles II leads to a reassertion of royal authority. And that means regulation of trade involving New England, which New England merchants don't like. We also get major episodes of the plague in New England. And there's shipwreck, there are fires. There's a terrible war with the Indians called the King Philip's War in 1675-76. And all of these disasters are interpreted by the clergy as God's sending a message to New England that they are declining in their religious fervor and commitment. So bad things happen. The clergy preach a message of necessary repentance. And actually, there are so many of these that they are given a special name in the history of Puritan preaching. They're called Jeremiads, as if, you know, they're reconstituting kind of the message of Jeremiah to the people of Israel. So now these preachers are preaching the same kind of message to the people of New England. At one point, the situation in the 1670s had become so bad, the Indian War, et cetera, that again, the government of Massachusetts called for a synod, representatives of the pastors and the congregations of New England, to make a full inquiry into the causes and state of God's controversy with us. This group met in 1679. They're called the Reformation, or the Reforming Synod, I should say. And they produced a summary of all past Jeremiads. It was called, a document called, The Necessity of Reformation. And I'll quote a little bit of it here. That God hath a controversy with his New England people is undeniable. the Lord having written his displeasure in dismal characters against us. Well, what was the cure? They went on to say a solemn and explicit renewal of the covenant. To that end, the reforming synod adopted a confession of faith. They had not had one before. And this was almost verbatim a quotation, a document from the English Congregationalists. It's called the Savoy Confession. And it, in turn, was based on the Westminster Confession, which was a Presbyterian document. But this one edits the Westminster Confession to make room for Congregationalist polity. And it went on to deny to the magistrate the right to interfere with the free exercise of conscientious religious convictions. So it's another step in the direction of religious liberty that came out of that 1679 reforming synod. Well, okay. England, or New England, is experiencing this declension as well as the new reality that's going on in Old England. And some very big changes occur in the 1680s. So let me just kind of set the stage here, and we'll do some of these changes when we get to our next episode, because I want to explain what's happening a little bit in Old England so you get the picture. Charles II, who's the son of Charles I, becomes King of England in 1660, and he reigns until 1685. He restores the Church of England, but the old Puritans who didn't want the Church of England, they end up forming independent churches. For a long time, those churches are illegal, but nonetheless, nobody's being burned at the stake. People are being thrown into prison, leaders and so forth, but nonetheless, these congregations form, and out of the Restoration period, there will come a Congregationalist denomination, there will come a Presbyterian denomination, and there will actually come Baptist congregations as well. So Christianity is fracturing in Old England, even though the dissenters are under legal persecution, but it's not draconian. They manage to survive. They manage to go forward. The king himself is, of course, Anglican, but secretly he's a Roman Catholic. He has agreed with his cousin, Louis XIV, that he will conduct a foreign policy that's in the interests of France. And when the time is right, he will take steps to bring back Roman Catholicism into England. And in exchange for those promises, the King of France actually puts him on the payroll of the French government, and big chunk of Charles II's income actually comes from France. When the English Parliament gets wind of what the king may or may not be doing, they proceed to a law that will prohibit Catholics from participating in the government. And this is in the 1670s. And they pass this law, and Charles, under political pressure, signs it. It's called the Test Act. And on account of the Test Act, you have to take communion in the Church of England in order to participate in the government. The law is put in effect, and somebody has to resign from the government because he's a Catholic. And who's that? That's the king's brother. Make a long story short, when Charles II dies in 1685, it's his Catholic brother who takes over as James II. And this throws everything into a turmoil, including religion in New England. They've got to deal with this stuff. And in dealing with this stuff, they have to chart a new path, new direction. And it's really going to leave a lot of their old Puritan ideals about New England in the past. So when we get together next time, I'll try to talk a little bit more about what's happening at the end of the 17th century. And at least one of our episodes will devote to the Salem witchcraft trials too, which is also occurs in this same period.
So fascinating. There has to be a movie covering all this, right?
Well, yeah.
Not the way that you do, though.
There are some movies. I mean, Nathaniel Hawthorne's A Scarlet Letter is based on this. And Hawthorne is very anti-Puritan, but nonetheless, it's a great novel. So I'm sure there are movies of that, and there are movies about Oliver Cromwell. And there are some about the Salem witch trials. At least there's a famous play about it. But anyway, it's been worked up. Sure.
Oh, so much more to learn next time as well. Dr. McKenzie, thanks so much for joining us today.
I am glad to have been with you. Thanks for having me.
You've been listening to The Coffee Hour. I'm Andy Bates.
I'm Sarah Golseth.
The Coffee Hour with Andy and Sarah is a production of KFUO. To support The Coffee Hour and KFUO Radio, visit KFUO.org. You can also text KFUO to 41444 or send an email to gifts@KFUO.org. And you can call us at 800-844-0524. KFUO. Christ for you, anytime, anywhere.